Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And today's show brought to you by Amazon Prime Exclusive Lore. They're going to also be sponsoring Theater of the Mind, and we've got a creepy one for you a little bit later on in the show, so stay tuned for that. Joining me this evening, Marita Voivod Crandall, and she has a book called New Orleans Vampires, History and Legend. And they definitely have a reputation as a home for all types of creatures of the night. We've heard of some of the dogman encounters out there. We've heard of the ghosts, of course, that are known, voodoo in that area. But what about vampires? Let's hear a little bit about this history. And this goes a little deeper than I'd ever heard before. So I'm excited to have our guest join us and talk about this. Marita, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. I'm excited.
Now, this off air, you told me kind of an interesting a topic about yourself. Can you give me a little bit of your pedigree, who you're actually related to?
I'll tell you, it's really funny. I moved to New Orleans because I just fell in love with the city, but I had a very serious marketing job in California, and my father was very upset with me for doing that. I was president of marketing for a huge conglomeration of companies, and I moved to New Orleans, and I told him I was going to Ten Bar and open up a vampire shop. And, you know, he was furious with me. But about a year later, he sent me a book, and he said, hey, you have to read this right away. You're not going to believe this. And it was The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova, which is a beautiful, beautiful vampire book about a father and daughter in search of Dracula for a very good reason. And it's a beautiful book. Anyway, as I was reading through it, our name is everywhere. And our last name is Voivod, but it's spelled W-O-Y-W-O-D. And it turns out Vlad Tempest was a four-time voivode. And we had no idea, except that, and this is a cute story, when my cousin moved, we're all from Germany, and my cousin followed my father to America, and she became president of a bank. Well, I was about 8 years old, and my cousin came to dinner one night, and she couldn't wait to tell us this story about a guy from Romania who had to get a loan. He goes to her office and immediately sees her name tag and falls on his knees and starts bowing to her. And so she, you know, got him off the floor and they did the loan. And on his way out the door, he says, "You are queen of the gypsies," you know. But we never knew what that really meant. And so not until this book came out, and then we started doing research. And sure enough, we do have ties to Romania and Vlad Tempest, and it's pretty cool.
Wow. So you are related to the original kind of theory behind Dracula. That's kind of got to be a strange historical connection for you.
It's strange because it's a coincidence. You know, if I had planned it, if we found out, but that's what made it really strange. Yeah. And I happen to have real fangs I was born with, which is also very strange. So it's kind of fun.
All right. Well, talk to me a little bit about this. When did your interest in vampire culture and lore begin?
Well, I mean, I've always liked vampires, but I was never a big fanatic. But Halloween costumes, that would be my go-to. And when I moved to New Orleans, I just thought that, you know, vampires kind of became synonymous with New Orleans, heavily due to Anne Rice's book, Interview with a Vampire, and, you know, all of her fiction. And then the movies just, and True Blood, you know, filming here. But we opened our shop 15 years ago, and I just thought there was a vampire tour. That's what really made me think of it. I was on a vampire tour. And I thought, boy, it would be so cool to walk down the street and have a little shop that, you know, catered to vampires. So that's what we did. We opened up a shop, and we say that for the first time we've been open to the public as well as vampires. And so, you know, everything has a little bit of a vampire twist. And that really led to more and more vampire information being, like, kind of thrown my way. And, I mean, the legends here are pretty amazing, and it never really crossed my mind if they were really true or not. You know, you want them to be. And History Press actually approached me and asked me if I would be interested in writing a book. So I had to submit the information, And actually, I honestly didn't believe there would be enough information to fill the pages of a book. And as I delved deeper into research and they liked my proposal, I was amazed by how much, like, just really rich historical information there is. And, it's just fascinating.
Right. I mean, obviously, like I said at the beginning of the show, many people are familiar with the ghosts and the pirate lore and the legends of voodoo that surround New Orleans. But vampires sounds more like something that would have been, you know, more of a recent historical attribute because of things like Anne Rice's books. But there is kind of a very deep culture that's gone on for a long time there. What was one of the oldest historical relevant stories you could find regarding New Orleans and the possibility of vampires?
Well, the one I thought was going to be the most interesting and the oldest to the city here during our colonization is the story of the Casket Girls, girls that were brought over from France and to really help populate the city with a better class of people, because under John Law, it was just a huge group of prostitutes and women that were not of virtue, and you know, just they weren't able to keep the interest of the men here, which what they really wanted to do. The government wanted to do what the king in France did many years prior with the king's girls, they were called. They were women that got trousseaus, and they went to, you know, Canada, and the men in Canada, they were able to colonize with these women. Well, here, first they hoped that the men from France would settle with Indians, and that didn't work out at all because they became very lazy and just became very accustomed to the Indian ways. And then they sent women that were, like I said, criminals and prostitutes, and the men, and some, then they sent women that said, they say that the men ran back into the woods because they were so unattractive. So they really needed some, you know, younger, more attractive women. And so that was the group called the Casket Girls that came from a home. And they came over with nuns. And there's many different versions of the legend. So now I have come up with the actual, I went back into time to really find out exactly the truth. The first time they were called the Casket Girls, because the legend is that they were bringing trousseaus with them that were coffin-shaped. And, you know, and that obviously was not the truth. And so what I found, though, which was really interesting, is that very many historians took what other historians wrote about these girls as fact and went on with that and then came up with their own versions, and that's why the legend has become so kind of convoluted. So the truth is that they did not come over with the Ursuline nuns. They're supposed to be held captive to this day in the Ursuline convent in the convent attic, these group of maidens that were turned vampire on their trip over on the ship. And they were carrying their trousseaus, which were called cassettes, and then later on actually referred to as caskets as well. And but that's what they called little boxes in France, a casket as well. So it was a misunderstanding.
What can you tell me about them being turned on the boat? I mean, that's just, you kind of glazed right over that aspect of the story. So who was bringing them over, and who would have been responsible for turning them?
Okay, well, there is a place called the Cepeter, which at the time, now it's a very nice hospital, but at the time it was a horrible place that held the insane girls, orphans, which were the Casket Girls, orphans, the insane, and also criminals. And when the nuns, Sister Gertrude, Sister Gertrude, was in charge of bringing them over here, she was not very nice, and she wasn't very nice to them. And in the research, I found that she played a very cruel trick on them, and she was supposed to keep them under lock and key. Well, there's something else that came over with them, we suspect. And so at that point, that's where the legend kind of starts. But when they came over, they were then supposedly married off right away and then just kind of disappear. Well, so the legend is that they were then they were turned vampire on the ship by something else that she brought over that she was supposed to dispose of for the king. And so nobody really knows the entire truth to that part, but it certainly wasn't the Ursuline nuns that brought them over. It was definitely a gray nun, a sister gray nun. So that's what they think, is that they were turned by some devilish creature because everybody was dying on the ship, and these girls somehow survived and then were very sick when they arrived and quickly married off and then really just kind of disappeared. But it said that the nuns took them under their care. And the Earth Alliance, over, you know, centuries, have been in charge of taking care of girls and teaching. And so because they were turned by, on their trip over, the Earth Alliance felt responsible for them and then kept them up in the attic of the convent. So that's the legend.
Now, are there legends of you know, obviously we've often been led to believe you become a vampire by becoming bitten by a vampire, but there has to be a genesis to how the first vampire began, right? I mean, and how that happened. Do they believe that these are demonic infestations that may have turned these girls? Do they believe that it was, you know, kind of like we've seen in the Hollywood versions, kind of an overlord vampire who has the ability to turn others? How does that even work in the history?
Well, there's many, again, different versions of history. It goes back to Egypt. You know, there's even in the I can never say that word, heliograph, the pictures that they draw. Okay. there are creatures that
Oh, my God, now I can't say the word. Hieroglyph. Oh, my God, what have you done to me? That is so weird that you have truncated my, or screwed up my mind in that way by mispronouncing it.
Sorry.
Now I can't even think of it. Hieroglyphs, that's it, hieroglyphs, okay.
Hieroglyphs.
Back on the track, all right, good.
They are depicted in those, and, you know, I mean, really, first time there's been any kind of culture, there was some kind of vampiric creature that fed off of human blood. And so I think with more than it being demonic, I mean, I think, and a lot of the research I've done too, it turns into being really just another one of God's creatures that is just a preys on humans. You know, it's monster-like, but like a black widow spider mates and kills. You know, it's just another version of some something that is on this earth rather than it being demonic. And that's why it's so confusing to people. And that's why vampires can draw you in, and, you know, because there is that mask of humanity. So it's not necessarily anything to do with demons. It's just a creature that is kind of.
So it's neither good nor bad. It is just part of nature, just part of life.
Exactly.
See, the scary stories are true, folks. Amazon Prime exclusive Lore explores that now in a 6-episode chilling anthology series. They've got an executive producer from The Walking Dead and one from The X-Files that have come together along with the podcast phenomena Lore that has over 70 million downloads. They've got creator and narrator Aaron Mankey exploring some of the most terrifying tales throughout history. Each one has been uniquely creepy and tailored to fit this story. They will look at myths and legends that have a rooted historical folklore truth and then twisted, exposing the timeless terrors that still haunt us today. Real life can scare you to death. Watch it exclusively on Amazon Prime this October. Started on Friday the 13th. It's available right now exclusively on Amazon Prime Video. And they cover some of the most chilling stories and folklore. You guys are going to absolutely love it. If you love what you hear on our show, you're going to love what you see on Amazon Prime's exclusive Lore. Go check it out for yourself. It's a great thing to bundle in for the night. If you've got a cold, rainy night, then make sure that you sit down and enjoy this program together as a family. And it's really great because the history of it is so intriguing. They give you the background and the histories to these stories and where these legends and lore came from. And you can honestly see why people would believe the things they believed. And in some instances, it's left you scratching your head about just what exactly did happen. There's not always science behind what happens. There's the supernatural. Check it out exclusively on Amazon Prime Video. All right, so we've got the story of the Casket Girls, and again, you're able to go back. How hard is it, especially for stories that old, Marita, to peel back those pages of history and find the truth of those stories?
It took a year, and I went to the New Orleans Historic Collection, and I mean, through book after book after book, and you'd find one tidbit, and it's so exciting when you find something that's relevant. And a lot of what I found was in footnotes, in these huge novel-type books, you know. of research, and I'd find a little footnote that said something about the Casket Girls and what wasn't true and what was true, and I was like, what? So then I found that book, and I mean, it was really fascinating, but it was very difficult. And there's one picture in my book. This is about Saint Germain, which is another legend. He's our probably the second. Well, when I finished the Casket Girls, I thought there was going to be nothing more interesting than that. And then I delved into Saint Germain, who was a gentleman who lived on Royal Street here in the early 1900s, 1903. And the rumor is that he was very charismatic in town. And then one night he had a female guest in his home, and she then jumped off the balcony and said that she jumped on purpose because he tried to bite her, and he in fact did bite her. She survived for about 2 more weeks, and the police came, you know, immediately. And they, of course, didn't believe it because he was a very affluent man in town. He threw lavish parties. And so they said, you know what, why don't you come to the police station tomorrow morning and we'll sort this all out. Well, he disappeared overnight, and he left all of his wealth behind. When they broke into his home, it was chilling. They found bottles of wine that were half full of wine and half human blood. And so, you know, they started to believe her story a little more. Well, many people believed that Saint Germain, or many people thought that Saint Germain was not even a real person, but he claimed to be the Saint Germain, the same person, or related to the same person from the 1400s. And so that, you know, was intriguing to me. So I went back into time there, and that was also very time intensive, but fascinating. And then people were even saying, well, it's even, you know, rumored that Saint Germain was not a real person, that he was just, people would talk about him, but there was really no person there. Well, I was able to prove that wasn't true. There actually absolutely was a very charismatic man named Saint Germain in the 1400s who was most likely given as, his father was one of the, this is another name I can never say, but there I go again. I'm going to try to read it so that I can pronounce it correctly. Rakoczy, it's R-A-K-O-Z-C-Y, Rakoczy of Transylvania. That was most likely his father. But there was a lot of political turmoil going on, so he gave him to the Medici family. And that's why this gentleman, who actually did exist, was so well-versed in music and art and literature and science. And he was, a very unusual person. And they say that he could turn faulted gems into magnificent masterpieces. So this is a true story. The king at the time, in the 1400s, had a diamond that he had appraised for about 9,000, you know, whatever currency they have there. And he, Saint Germain said, well, it should be worth much more. I can fix that for you. So he asked him to do that. He said he needed a month's time. And sure enough, he presented the exact same stone. They had many people verify that it was the same stone, and it was in perfect condition. And they brought it back to the same jeweler, who then was going to give him way more money for it. But he decided to keep it. The king kept it as a treasure. So anyway, but the thing about Saint Germain that I think so many people overlooked back then, they thought he was a sorcerer, and he used that to his advantage. He would tell stories, even at that time, as if he had been alive 500 years prior. He was a very good linguistic, character. Anyway, what they overlooked, though, was how intelligent he was. And there was a person who did research about being able to fix flaws in diamonds. And he was just able to figure it out in a way earlier time frame, because he invented a certain kind of dye also way ahead of his time that he ended up giving to the French king. He liked to help economies. Anyway, that somehow he used that same kind of process and was able to figure out how to get flaws out of jewels. And it wasn't really magic. It was magical, you know, but he was just a really amazing alchemist. So so that's where it all stems back from, is this gentleman. And speaking about research, every time, like I said, I would find something amazing out about that this real person really existed, I found a story that I still get chills when I think about it. He walked into an opera house in London and immediately started writing operas, and that they would let him do it. They didn't know him. Nobody there knew him, but he was so, you know, good at it. So he wrote an opera that every time it played, they got a standing ovation, the woman who sang it. And the King's Opera House was across the street. So the gentleman who ran the King's Opera House for many years, like 40 years, retired, and he bought his wife a home called Four Maids on a Row. And in that, in the entryway, he had murals painted. And there's one mural he had painted above the entry door that is a music book open to an opera. And it's the opera that Saint Germain wrote. And around it is the Flower of Eternity, and it says, dedicated to Saint Germain. And so why would he do that? That opera never played at the King's Opera House. And of all the operas he could have chosen, right, there's something really crazy. So I went back and I tried to find that, if that picture still existed. I did everything. I tried realtors. I tried photographers. I tried everything. The house is actually, it was on the market. I think it's still on the market for millions. And it's 55,000 square feet. Anyway, I found out that it does still exist, and I found the photographer who took a picture of it for something else, and he sold it to me to use in the book. So, you know, things like that, to these little tidbits of proof that this man actually existed and how revered he was in many different ways. I mean, he was an amazing musician and also, you know, way ahead of their time in dyes and diamonds. And even his death has suspect around it because he had nothing, apparently, when he died. And there was no sign of anything. His friends, nobody went to the funeral. So many people believe that they faked that funeral so that he could actually disappear and move on again, most likely to New Orleans in 1903.
That sounds very Lestat, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
From Anne Rice's book, Interview with a Vampire. I mean, you've kind of got this aristocratic guy who's been around forever and seems to always have to be on the move. Now, that you find a story like that, right? And it's pretty intriguing. And it's also great that we've found all of these strange pictures of people like Nicolas Cage and John Travolta and a few other celebrities that are hundreds of years old that look spot on to them. And I know that's really kind of helped to build this weird culture and lore and belief system that even people like John Travolta and Nicolas Cage may be somehow vampiric and existing many years beyond normal lifespans. So to hear stories like this, it seems that kind of theory has been around forever.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely. Well, they actually referred to him as a vampire. He was in the 1400s. He was referred to as a vampire. So, in some points, and then here as well, he never ever, even in that day, was seen eating with his guests. He would drink. He would not. He would storytell while other people were eating. So there's something to that too. I mean, it's fascinating. It really is. And he did say he had the elixir of life. So Madame Pompadour got that out of him. Apparently, she got the recipe, but I don't think she did it right.
don't hold back. How do you really feel about it?
Well, I do want to tell you one thing. You know, I'm a very realistic person, and I mean, it's funny, I'm also magical in many ways, but you know, when people ask me, do you believe in vampires? Well, I think I certainly don't believe in the vampire that we've created in movies, even though I would love for them to be true. I mean, it would be amazing, right? But there may very well have been or is the kind of character I talked about before, you know, a character that is still in hiding in the shadows and now and then maybe comes out and, you know, like ghosts, for instance. You know, before New Orleans, I had never had a ghost experience. Since I've moved here, I've had three, and they're honest-to-God ghost experiences. So now I do, you know, I know there are ghosts, but many people don't, and it's still this thought, like, are there ghosts, you know, and why don't we know yet? Why don't we know for sure? Well, I think we really do know for sure. It's just that people don't want to believe it. But same thing maybe with vampires. Maybe they really do hide in the deepest shadows, and now and then one pokes up, and that's why they're still in, you know, fiction and legends and modern day. But something happened to me, and this really happened, and I still don't believe it myself, but it did happen to me. So I first opened up my vampire shop, and it was a horrible shop, the way it was laid out. It was on a street where you had to walk down a carriageway before you could get to the shop. And at the end of that carriageway was a huge mirror, and there was nowhere else to go. It just, you know, that was it. The mirror was at the end. And then you walk to the right and go into the shop. But it was a long entryway, and it was really spooky, and I think it turned a lot of people off. So we didn't do very well there. But I had just opened up, and we were open very late at night because my husband worked late in the evening, so I took advantage of it, and I'd work until he came to pick me up to kind of go with the vampire theme. Well, one evening, pretty early evening, but it was dark, I had a German Shepherd who worked with me every night, and she sat on my side, and then when I went into the candle studio, we make our own fortune candles, she would alert me if somebody walked in, because I couldn't see. I could just see her at the desk, and she could see the door, and she would sit up and, you know, like, let me know that someone had walked in. Well, one evening, she started to growl, and she never growled. I mean, she was a German Shepherd, but she was very cool. And she was growling, and she stood up. I was pouring wax, and I couldn't stop, and so I just yelled out, and I didn't want to make the person feel uncomfortable. So I said, hey, I'll be right there, you know. And I could hear that they walked with a cane. I could just hear that. So I made the corner as fast as I could, and I tried to get her to calm down, and she never once sat down. I could feel the grumbling of her growl through my hand. I couldn't hear her, but she was like, you know. I'm like, Elka, stop it. Anyway, the entire time this man was in the shop. So the man, if you could describe a person that looked like a real vampire, you know, he would. He wasn't like a fake, like with makeup on or in any kind of costume. And I wish I could say he had like a Greek accent or Italian accent, but it sounded Romanian. Like, you know, I mean, I kept wanting to make him something else because it sounded so stupid. But anyway, he was dressed in really nice, like clothes that seemed to be made for him, like very elegant looking, beautiful cane. In his late 40s, probably, very dark complexion, you know, but just, I don't know, just if you could, a real person that could be a vampire, that's what he looked like. Anyway, we always have a little spiel when people come into our shop to make them feel comfortable and kind of explain what's going on. So I started to tell him, you know, everything in here is handcrafted just for us, and he completely ignored me. And nobody makes me nervous, and for some reason, I was extremely nervous, and I think part of that had to do with my dog not stopping to growl. But so he, you know, was walking around the shop, and then all of a sudden, he finally said, "Do you have the history of the vampire?" And I said, "No, you know, we only sell books that are signed by the author, but it's a good idea. I should investigate that." And you know, I started talking still, and he completely ignored me again. And then he said, and he didn't look at me. He just said, "I know people who would be very interested in this," but way better than I could say it, you know. The funny thing was, or the eerie thing, was that he wasn't really talking to me. He was really talking to himself, like, he was feeling like the shop itself was like almost like a compliment to him somehow. So, like, there's really, you know, a shop dedicated to vampires. It seemed like that was rolling through his mind rather than anything else, and that's what made it so creepy and eerie for me. So after that, he didn't say one more thing, and then all of a sudden, he just, you know, turned and walked out, and I was still saying goodbye and, you know, a couple things. Anyway, as he walked out the door, I sat down simultaneously. I sat down, and my dog sat down, and I petted her head, and I said out loud, I said, "That was weird." And we have windows on the left side, like at the street side. So he now was walking out the door and making a left. And on the windows, my husband walks with purpose, and I sense out of my peripheral vision that here comes my husband. And I was really happy about it, too, because it was just the creepiest experience. So he's walking, and they, you know, we're going to run into each other. So when he walked in the door, I told my husband, I said, "Boy, that guy was really strange." And he said, "What guy?" And I said, "The guy who just left out here with the cane." He goes, "Nobody just walked out of here." I said, "Steve, the guy who just walked out of here with the cane." And then he, like, my husband doesn't play practical jokes. And he was like, "Marita, no one walked out of here." So I ran out the door and looked both ways. And we're, like, in the middle of the block. And, you know, people can walk faster than you think, actually. But there was no way that this guy would have been gone already. And he was gone. Just absolutely nowhere to be seen. And there's no way he can go anywhere else in the carriageway. I mean, it's bricks, you know, brick hallway. So that really happened, and the weird part about it is I know that there aren't vampires, you know, but where did this guy go? And when I'm in my shop late at night making candles, many times the my back of my neck, you know, gets a tingle, and I just know one day he's going to walk into my shop again. I just know it. I'm in a different location now, but I know I'm going to see that man again, and I don't know why I feel that way, but that was creepy.
Before we go to break, you've made the mention a couple times now, you don't believe in the romanticized kind of Hollywood version of what a vampire is. But do you believe that vampires exist in other forms?
I think I do. I think I do. Before, if you would have asked me this about 3 years ago, I would have said no. But just the more research I do and the more experiences I have, I do believe there's something there. I do.
What do you think it is that you're running up against? I mean, in that, I mean, you know, we've heard of energy vampires. I know there are these, and I hate to use the word cult because it sounds ridiculous to me, but there are these cult-like moments where people, you know, they're sanguine vampires. They have bleeders that are willing to give them blood, and they drink it. You know, to me, that just seems like fantasy role play, and I'm sure I'm going to get a bunch of pissed off emails from bloodsuckers around the world. But what do you make of that? I mean, the different types, and do you give any credence, especially to things like true energy vampires?
Well, I would have to agree with you with the, you know, I think that because vampires are such an attractive idea, you know, living forever and getting energy from others and being dangerous but being somehow, you know, engaging. I think people want so badly for that type of vampire to exist that they create what they is their own reality of that. And some people take it very seriously, and I think it's not very healthy for themselves and for others. You know, they're not vampires. They're basically role-playing, like you said. And, you know, I mean, I guess they can have fun with it as long as they're careful and stay within themselves, the groups. But as far as psychic vampires, I mean, I think there are definitely people that drain your energy. I think calling them vampires is, you know, a little bit same thing. Like, people just want to identify as vampires so badly, so they've created that being a vampire. But, they're, you know, it's true. They do take your energy. Many people do. You can feel them coming, and it's so, I don't know. But how I would describe a vampire is a creature that is a monster, like horrific, that, you know, we've now turned into this glamorous being, primarily, I mean, I guess.
Which is weird, right? Because weird. He wasn't, Dracula was not a handsome character. Bela Lugosi made him kind of an attractive foreigner. But the original incarnation of what Bram Stoker created was much more in line with what we've seen in Nosferatu.
Right, yeah.
This spindly, creepy, pointy-eared, tufts of hair, you know, pointy teeth freak. It was more of a monsterish figure taking trying to appear human than it was a human that had monstrous intentions.
Exactly, and yeah, and that's what I would think. Like Bram Stoker, also, you know, he got a lot of his information from Barney the Vampire, which was one of the first, very first vampire literature. And if you haven't seen Barney, it was a Penny Dreadful in London, you know, many years ago. But Bram Stoker actually got some of his vampire information from Barney, and Barney's wonderful. But Barney's also a creepy, creepy creature, more Nosferatu-like. And so, yeah, I think Bela Lugosi was the first attractive vampire.
Right. All right. Well, with that said, and I do want to explore a little bit more about that with you, but today we've got a brand new Theater of the Mind presented by Amazon Prime's exclusive Lore, the 6-episode anthology series appearing right now on Amazon Prime exclusive. So check that out for yourself. But today we've got what could be an encounter with a vampire as we dig deeply into the archives of Darkness Radio here on Theater of the Mind. Ralph Hanley's real-life walk with a vampire. I know how crazy what I'm about to say sounds. Trust me. I've been embarrassed to share this story for the better part of 20 years, and I cannot even say for certain what it was that happened to me, but I can say I've never bar-hopped again the same way and will certainly be more careful with who I pay attention to. It was the mid-90s, and I went with a couple of my friends to visit New Orleans at Mardi Gras. This was a bucket list topper for all of us, and I had no real idea of the paranormal history of New Orleans. My only information was the fact that it was a great place to party and have the time of your life with some of the most beautiful women on earth, all while listening to some of the best music in the world. That was more than enough for me to know I had to experience it myself. Now, our first few nights were pretty uneventful. It was fun, but nothing out of the ordinary where it came to high strangeness. It was now our third night in town, Saturday. We were planning on getting out early and coming home late. The night was fun, rowdy, raucous, and filled with revelry. And about 10 p.m., we found ourselves in yet another overpacked bar, waiting inordinately long amounts of time to get our libations. But we loved every minute of it. I mean, the people watching, that was amazing. The energy was like nothing I'd ever experienced. It was powerful. Then, amidst the sound of the people mixed with the lively music, things suddenly sounded muted. I guess that's the best word to describe it. Like all the noise was still there, but someone huge had put their hands over my ears to block the harsh loudness. I scanned my surroundings, and I saw a gorgeous woman standing directly across from me. Her eyes were locked on mine, and I couldn't look away. I didn't even want to look away. She was perfection. Long, dark, wavy hair, beautiful skin, amazing features, and the most electric green eyes I'd ever seen. I did the lame guy move of the slight smile and the head nod. She just stared. It was intense and a little weird at the same time. I pointed to my drink, offering to buy her one in a pantomime movement. She just smiled and stared. Then, through this crowd, I saw the biggest black man I'd ever seen. This guy was a mountain of a man, and he moved behind her, and the ease and flow of his movement was almost eerie. I mean, this place was packed, and he seemed to just glide through the crowd like a hot knife through butter. He got directly behind her and stopped. His head turned, and he stared a hole right through me. Ah, crap, her boyfriend. That was the exact thought that popped into my mind. The music and conversations were still very muted, and then he turned and walked away. Within seconds, he was just gone. Where, I have no clue, but he was gone. She began to make her way over to me and got within inches of my face, and I tilted my head towards her, lowering my ear, expecting to hear her try to begin a conversation, and I was shocked when all I heard was a very loud, whispery voice ask,
"Do you want to get out of here?"
I smiled coyly and nodded. I looked to my friends to give them a heads up, and they were nowhere to be seen. They'd blended into the crowd and found someone to occupy them as well. She turned and led me out of the bar and down the street. I have to admit, I felt buzzed, but not drunk or tipsy. It was more of like this underwater feeling, and my hearing had not quite returned to my satisfaction. She reached back, took my hand, and just kept walking. I was excited and nervous, part of me hoping this was going to end with an amazing memory. The other part of me thinking, aw crap, she's going to lead me into an alley where her big boyfriend is waiting for me. And it was almost like she sensed my fear. She stopped, she turned and gave me a quick grin, then leaned forward again and in the whispery voice said,
"Drinks, dancing, or a walk?"
Interesting. She was leaving it up to me. Now my guard started to ease up a bit. I replied with, "A walk would be great." She smiled again and off we went. Her name was Vanessa, and she revealed she was a local and loved this time of year and all the people and the energy they brought. She was soft-spoken but had this strong voice that was captivating. We popped into a dive bar, one that she seemed to frequent a lot. We shared a drink and some more small talk. This woman was unreal to look at, and all I could think of was how much I wanted to kiss her. She leaned in and filled my ear with another whispery message.
"Soon enough. I don't like to rush."
That's when we both noticed the hulking figure from the first bar walk in. This guy was monstrous and filled up the damn frame of the door. But no one seemed to even take notice. I mean, how can you not notice someone this imposing? She grabbed my hand and without a word, we were on our way out through another door. "Hey, am I going to end up getting my ass kicked tonight by your angry boyfriend?" I called out over the loudness. She just shook her head and kept moving me through the crowd with her head down. By now, I was kind of getting tired of being a pull toy, now feeling like my safety may be in real danger, and I stopped short. She turned to face me, her face contorted in a bit of a puzzled look. Then it softened, and she came forward and planted a kiss on me. And man, what a kiss. I would now follow this woman through the gates of hell wearing nothing but a bikini made of bacon if she asked me. She smiled and whispered to me again,
"Let's go someplace away from here."
And off we marched. After a bit more of a walk, we had cleared most of the main thoroughfare, and she kept looking back over both of our shoulders as we made our way through the crowd. We ducked down a side street and I stopped again. "Listen, I like you and this has been fun, but things are getting weird," I said in a half-scolding tone. She just stared deeply into my eyes and gently pushed my back up against the wall. She reached up and took my face in her hands and kissed me again. and then let out a slight giggle. My tensions started to ease up a bit, and I took a breath. We began kissing even more deeply and passionately. I was really getting into it. I opened my eyes to look at this strikingly beautiful creature and was shocked to see her eyes were open too. Then, I know what I saw, but it made no sense. They seemed to fog over and get very milky, very weird. Then she bit my damn tongue. It wasn't even a playful or sexy nibble, it was a bite. I yanked my head back, and I could taste blood in my mouth. "What the hell?" I grumbled. She looked sad and leaned in for a kiss. I thought maybe she just got too aggressive and was embarrassed, so we began kissing again. She locked on my tongue and began sucking it. At first it was kind of erotic, but then it started to feel creepy as hell. Was she sucking the blood from my tongue where she just bit me? I pivoted. We changed spots. She now had her back to the wall and didn't seem to like that one bit. Her face grew very twisted and angry looking. Then I felt it. It was like a lightning bolt attached to a baseball bat. A hand jammed between us and pushed me hard. It was our dark follower. He shoved me straight to the ground and grabbed her. I started to open my mouth to protest. My tongue was throbbing and on fire. It was like he knew what I was about to say, and he spun very quickly to face me and said,
"Stay down. You don't want nothing she's got. She's a bad one."
And then he turned, grabbed her by the wrist, and they scurried out onto the street. I stood up and I rushed to the street, looking, trying to find them and see what the hell was happening. They were gone. I mean, like, poof, gone. That guy was like a moving freight train. There's no way he could just vanish. But he did, with her in tow. That's when I noticed that I could hear again. Clearly, very loud, like someone removed their hands from my ears and all the sounds of a party street filled my ears. My mouth and tongue hurt like hell, and I made my way back to the bar where it all began. I found my friends and refused to tell them what happened. I told them I just tripped and bit my tongue. They suggested we get some antiseptic on that right away. And by antiseptic, they meant tequila shots. I went along and I spent the rest of the night looking over my shoulder for the ominous one that got away and my dark angel that seemed to be watching my back that night. It took a week to get the feeling back in my tongue. As if that weren't strange enough, when I did find my boys again, I asked where they had gone, that I'd looked all over for them and couldn't find them. They gave me a set of very confused, weird looks in response and said, "Dude, you looked right at us and then took off out of the bar on your own. We thought you punked out and went back to the hotel to sleep." They didn't see the girl. I mean, the most amazing girl in the history of all girls. They saw me look around and just leave the bar on my own. This is the first time I've shared this story, and seeing that it has not brought me any relief or comfort in doing so will most likely be my last.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness, and I want to thank all of you that have already made donations to help us with our Halloween for Hunger campaign. It's not too late. We are still far away from our goal of 15,000, but we're edging our way up there very quickly with your help. If you could please just go to darknessradio.com, click on the Halloween for Hunger banner, and make a donation now. $1, $5, $10, $20, whatever you can afford to do will go a long way to help feed people here in the United States that are in crisis situations. Your neighbors, your friends, your coworkers, people you may know and love but have no idea that they're going through this personal tragedy. Well, Second Harvest Heartland is the way to help them. By making these donations, every $1 that we can supply them supplies 3 meals to a person in need. That's right, $1 supplies 3 full meals to a person in need. Our goal this year is $15,000, and I know we can do that. I know the paranormal community has got it in their heart to reach deep and help. Listen, we get almost 300,000 downloads of this episode. I'm just asking for 15,000 of you to donate $1, or one of you to donate 15,000, whatever works best for you. But if you have that, please make that happen, and let's make a big difference. That will supply 45,000 meals to families and individuals in need right here in the heartland of our planet, right here in good old US of A. So you go again to darknessradio.com, darknessradio.com. Click on the Halloween for Hunger banner at the top of the page, and that's where you'll get it. If you're having trouble for any reason finding that on our website, just email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and I will send you the link. That's dave@darknessradio.com, and I'll send you the link for the Halloween for Hunger campaign. We're back. Marita Voivod Crandall, I hope I'm saying that right, New Orleans Vampires, History and Legend, is back with us, and just heard a freaky story from Theater of the Mind. I want to ask you about this. You know, you said that you believe these creatures might be, if there was, it would be more of a demonic, more of a monster-like creature that, again, maybe it took more of a human guise just to fit in so that it could get access to human blood or to us as livestock easier. But do you believe, I mean, there are accounts of this that go back centuries upon centuries of people's belief that there are vampires among us. And although you don't believe that necessarily the romanticized versions exist, do you think that there is a point in history where a real creature like this may have walked the earth?
Well, I mean, like I said, I'm starting to feel like maybe there is. The more research I do, the more real it becomes. But there's also, you know, tuberculosis and yellow fever that gave very similar symptoms as a vampire-type disease, I guess. And so, in fact, I'm having a gentleman from the Pharmacy Museum here come and do a lecture at our little vampire speakeasy about just that, tuberculosis and vampirism, and the terror that was going through the city here back in the day. One thing that's kind of interesting is if vampires were evolving as people have evolved, then maybe they have taken on more of a, you know, human-like form over the centuries. But barbers, for instance, the barber pole is fascinating to me in that if I had been a vampire back in the day, I definitely would have befriended a barber because they let blood, and that would have been a very easy source where it was not, you know, you weren't killing somebody, you were getting blood. But could vampires even socialize? You know, if you make up all these, we try to make them very human, but is this creature, if it exists, even a creature that could socialize back in the time or really have to live in the shadows and feed off of rats and derelicts and, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer, but I don't know.
Well, you were talking... You were talking in the last segment about the charismatic man who had moved to the French Quarter in the early 1900s, Saint-Germain, and when he left, they actually found, you said, bottles of wine that had been mixed with human blood. Now,
yes, many.
Is that part of urban legend, or is that fact that they truly found wine mixed with blood?
Well, I believe it's more urban legend. I couldn't find anything, even though it's referenced in many, many... different publications. It's not like there was nothing in the police records that showed that. And I did go back to the police records. So there was actually no mention of Saint Germain having purchased that house, the particular house that they were talking about. There was a gentleman named Saint Germain that lived here that owned different properties at the time. And, but many, you know, maybe he rented it. So there was no real thread that I could follow, but that has been like reported for, I mean, in legends, since about, when I find the last story, about the 1970s, early 70s. And it took place in 1903. So, you know, I have to say it's probably more urban legend than fact.
As somebody that loves the vampire legends and lore, were you kind of disappointed that none of these left you with the, maybe?
Yes, although,
yes, although.
That being said, I am one of the few people probably in the world that have had the privilege of having a private tour of the attic of the Ursuline Convent, and that experience was more chilling than I could even explain. I actually, when I was marketing my book, I had the first 100 come out with a leather copy and a secret letter of my experience in the attic because they wouldn't let me publish it in the book. the convent. I took pictures, and they said I could take them, but I couldn't publish them. So I can tell you what I found, though, and it was, I mean, I can't tell you what an experience this was for me that I could actually go up there. First, when I was talking to my guide, we met for lunch first, and I thought, obviously, that the attic would have boxes in it and maybe some artifacts from the archdiocese and, you know, whatever else. Anyway, she started to tell me, no, the attic is actually empty, and there are 6 bed chambers, and they're empty now. I'm like, wait a minute, what? So we went up there, and it was storming, of course, that day. It couldn't have been more magical. So we get there, and she let me kind of roam around at the bottom of the convent while she was doing something, and there's all these, you know, old artifacts of the nuns when they came over. That was magical in itself. But we got to the second floor. The attic's the third floor. The second floor, they have a library up there, and the books are all in French, but some are from the 1700s, some are from the 1800s, and there's a beautiful window overlooking the church garden, which is where the nuns used to have all their herbs for their healing properties. And so just being up there, you know, and then I knew I was going to get to the third floor, and she disappeared again, so I was looking through all these old books, and it really got my creative juices flowing. So we get up to the third floor, and if I were to do a haunted house of the attic, I mean, I know exactly what I would do now. I wouldn't change a thing. So the hallway, she purposely left the lights off for me, and even when she turned the lights on, it was, you know, pretty freaky. But when she left them off, there were lights going through these tiny slivers of pieces of wood. When they build a house, there's slats, like many little slats,
right,
about a finger wide. Yeah.
Right.
And there's all these lights going through that almost look like laser beams, like kept there on purpose in case a vampire escaped, it would sear them, right? It was like all these little laser beams of light. And then there were 6 bed chambers that the doors were open. And the first one that we went into, and not a thing in the attic, not a thing, completely empty. The first room had the floor recessed. And I'm not just saying this is absolutely true. I have pictures of it. Just big enough to fit a coffin in. And there were 6 of them. And so these 6 holes, basically, were recessed. And then these laser beam lights going over them so that, imagine now, there were no coffins in them, but they were big enough to hold coffins. And it was almost, I started getting this feeling like they removed everything for my benefit so that I wouldn't see it, you know, like to satisfy my curiosity. Yeah, there's really nothing up here. But it actually made me ask more questions, because why, first of all, is an attic that's so valuable completely empty? Second of all, why would these, like, holes be there in the floor? And it just, none of it made sense. And then I stood on the legend is many times, and this is true, the shutters are all sealed shut on the top floor, which is unusual anyway in New Orleans, because that keeps heat in and heat rises, so you would really want to have, you know, more air going through. But the shutters on the third floor are always sealed shut, and I was standing now on the inside of the shutter where these vampires are supposed to stand, you know, wanting to get out, and it was pitch black, and I took the most amazing photo of that room, and I didn't want to leave. I mean, it was chilling standing there. But once in a while, one of those shutters does open up, and I've only seen it once in my 16 years of living here, and immediately they seal it shut again. So my tour up there really didn't answer any of my questions, because it actually gave me more questions of, did they just move them while I was gone and then put them back? I mean, I really didn't believe in these vampire maidens until I had the tour of the convent attic. It was crazy. Chilling.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and, you know, I wonder if somebody went up there and saw that and kind of envisioned that, and maybe that was how they propagated the whole legend and lore to begin with.
Well, I think the legend really started from the word casket girl, because they were actually referred to as casket girls, which was referring to their trousseaus.
Right, but I mean about them keeping them in the attic.
Yeah,
when you see the attic, that would have made sense of, look, this is exactly what we found. That must have been awesome to see.
It was unbelievable.
That sounds like a movie set waiting to be used.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, listen, folks, maybe blood and wine is not your mix. Maybe you want something more angular, or cassis, opulent even. And if you aren't familiar with those wine terms, congratulations, you're just like me. I don't care if wine clubs and critics babble on about the herbaceousness of the wine. I just want to know, does it taste good? And luckily, I found First Leaf. It's the only wine club that's based on your tastes. I just received my First Leaf order, and these are some damn good wines. Now, here's how it works. Customize your First Leaf order, and you do that by selecting the color, the wine regions, and frequency of your wine shipments. First Leaf then creates an introductory 3-pack of wine to get you started. All right? And the wine is so good. I'm not even a wine guy. This was something that I've been slowly building towards. People keep trying to push wine. I mean, you got to try this. And I've started to find some really good tastes, flavors, blends, and vineyards that I've really begun to enjoy. And being able to look through First Leaf and find exactly what I want, it was such a relief. And then to get them, and I'm wondering, all right, now is this going to be some little home craft? And no, these are absolutely delicious. And with First Leaf's introductory pack, you're going to get 3 for just $5 each. Did you hear me? That's right. Just 3 for just $5 each. And normally, these bottles of wine go for around $20 a pop, if not more. Now, when your bottles arrive, you rate the wine to get personalized selections based on your unique tastes. And the more wines you rate, the better your recommendations will be. First Leaf eliminates the middleman and works directly with the world's foremost wineries in France, Italy, and Napa Valley. First Leaf is my new favorite way to rate and buy quality wine. And listen, they're going to just keep making it better for me because the more I rate, the better the wine they're going to find to attach to me. And I'm already at the point where I can't figure out how they could find wine that I'm going to enjoy more than the wines I've already gotten. So here's what I want you to do. Order your 3-pack of introductory wine for just $15. Go to tryfirstleaf.com/darkness. That's 3 bottles of wine, you heard me, for only $15 at tryfirstleaf, firstleaf.com/darkness. Experience First Leaf today at tryfirstleaf.com/darkness. All right. Marita, again, it's not blood and wine, but this is some damn good wine if you're looking to get into the wine tasting and enjoyment of that beverage. But boy, the idea, as you were saying before, those are the rich moments of story, right? Why do we believe that vampires drink blood? I thought when we look back at some of the oldest folklore that they would drink everything from blood to seminal fluid to whatever kind of bodily secretions they could get.
Well, maybe it's because wine just sounds better.
No, I mean blood. Why do vampires go for blood? Why do we believe that's the taste that they go for? As I said, I thought originally they were able to find, you know, or the vampiric creatures, they lived on our life force and more than just our blood. It was different parts of us that they could use to strengthen themselves. When did it settle on? Was it Bram Stoker's version that changed the whole thing to just blood?
You know, I'm not sure, because I think even Nosferatu just drank blood.
Right.
If I remember, and Varney as well. So, and that was before, Varney was way before Bram Stoker, and he drank blood also. That's the first thing he did was climb up a window and ravage a girl and bite her neck. So, and that was way before Bram Stoker's Dracula. So, you know what, too, though? This is interesting, and this is true, that they've recently found that when an older person is given a transfusion of a younger person's blood, mm-hmm. it absolutely rejuvenates their system. So maybe it had some, you know, true chemical value.
Well, they've said, and I know this is strange, and I don't know how scientific it is. I mean, this has just always been part of the urban legend I've heard, but one of the reason women outlive men is because of their menstrual cycle and the constant bleeding, the constant refreshing of the blood. And they've also found, and gosh, I'm trying to remember, this was a scientific point that was just brought up a few years ago, that people that donate blood cut their chances of heart attacks and other blood-related diseases more than in half. by donating blood on a regular basis because it keeps the blood fresh. When you remove a pint of blood, your body works to produce and create new blood. So it is, it's always that kind of refreshing of the blood. It's the bringing the nutrients in and kind of, I guess, like a bush or a tree, right? You trim it back to make it grow even stronger. So giving a pint of blood, you actually help, you know, keep your life flow moving longer. So maybe that's part of the whole cycle of life as well with the vampiric blood fascination.
That's, it could be very true. Yeah, like they used to use leeches, you know, even.
Right. Well, they still do in a lot of places for medical treatment to stimulate blood motion through amputated limbs or reattached limbs. And then you've got stories like Lady Bathory, right?
Who
reportedly was like one of the world's weirdest serial killers, and she would bathe and drink the blood of virgins, and she would kind of submerge herself in these tubs of virgin blood, and she believed she was kind of pulling in their energy and refreshing her own blood and giving her youth and beauty by using the blood of the virgins. We're a weird species, aren't we? The shit we come up with, Marita, is crazy.
It's true, but I mean, most of it has some kind of scientific background.
Right.
So.
Well, yeah, some hint or shadow of science, at least. Talk to me a couple more of the stories of New Orleans vampires. Isn't there, I believe it's regarding New Orleans. Isn't the Sting song from Dream of the Blue Turtles, Moon Over Bourbon Street, isn't that about a vampire?
I don't know that.
Oh,
I'll
my
have to
God.
Research that one.
Yeah, you got to look that up. I know there's a song, I think it's called Moon Over Bourbon Street by Sting, and I believe it's about vampires in New Orleans.
Well, that's one I've never heard of.
It's been a long time since I've heard it. Yeah, but you definitely check that out, and you can thank me later in your second book when you quote that bit.
We'll do that.
Let me hear about a couple more of the weird. Tell me about the brothers.
The Carter
terrorists.
Brothers.
Yeah, I want to hear about this.
John and Wayne Carter. So the legend is that they lived right across, like very close to my vampire shop here, and that they would tie up people up and then feed on them. They had no regard for them whatsoever. And they would cut their wrists daily and have blood drip into chalices, and they would drink that. And when they died, they would push them aside or bring them upstairs. And a little girl they had tied up was able to get out of her ties and ran into someone who took her to the police, and she told them their story. And at first they didn't believe it, but then sure enough they went to the Carter brothers' home, and there they found seven other people tied up, all almost on their deathbeds. And the brothers were tried and convicted of being serial killers, not of vampires. And then they were hung. And then they, here in New Orleans, you're put into a tomb for 1 year and 1 day. And so they were, you know, after they were hung, they were put into these tombs for exactly a year and a day. And when they went to push the bodies aside, there was nothing there. No clothes, no bones, nothing. And that's when the legend started that they really must have been vampires. So that story I researched extensively as well, and I found nothing about the Carter brothers, I have to say, and it was very sad for me. But I uncovered a lot of other things that had to do with that time frame, like bloodletting, and the barber's pole was a way to alert a vampire that they let blood there. And the towels, the barber pole is actually supposed to be, it's just red and white is how they started out, and that was the blood on the white towels that they would hang out to dry in the breeze. But then they had the pole so that people knew that that's where you would let blood, and also to announce it to vampires so that they could get their blood there. Later on, the America added blue to be more patriotic, but other barber poles are just red and white. And then also, what else came from the Carter brothers?
Now, what do we know to be true about these guys? I mean, did they really exist? Were there really the Carter brothers? Did they really get found for murder and some of this? Or, again, is this just some kind of twisted versions of history that took place elsewhere, or an amalgam of stories that have kind of found their way into one
legend? Yeah.
Legend,
that's
yeah.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't find anything about the Carter brothers ever having lived here. And that was sad.
Well, where did you find the genesis? I mean, there has to be a starting point. There had to be a reference to them at some point, whether it's fake or real. What did you find there?
It was more about, like you said, about many stories coming together, about people disappearing. You know, a lot of people move here to disappear, but other people come here to become whoever it is they want to be. and to prey on other people. And, you know, so that's kind of where it started. A lot of people were disappearing, and the mafia actually was also involved with both Saint Germain and the Carter Brothers legends. They used them to their advantage. And if somebody disappeared, they would say, oh, you know, I think Saint Germain came and got him or something. And that's a true story, too. The mafia really did use both the Carter Brothers and Saint Germain as excuses for bodies disappearing. So, you know, that's kind of interesting, I thought.
The mafia were using vampire legends to cover up their own crimes.
Correct.
That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very superstitious. This town is very superstitious, and so they would throw around the name Saint Germain, and people would just be fearful, and they would like pay up, and you know, I did do quite a bit of research about that. I didn't really weave that into the book, but it may be in another book.
So, now, you do have some werewolf lore from that area as well, is that correct?
Well, it's a character called Loup-Garou.
Rougarou. Rougarou, yeah.
And, yeah, I was actually just at the zoo doing some research about him. They have a character, a monster there that's in his depicting him. But, yeah, he's a swamp monster, very very similar to more of a Sasquatch, I would say, than a werewolf. But werewolves and vampires, you know, they have a history of hating each other. And so there are werewolf tribes here, people that identify much more with werewolves than they do with vampires. Mm. And I tell you what, they take it very seriously, because we've had people come into my vampire shop and they will be complaining about how there's nothing dedicated to them. We sell silver bullets, and they'll be really seriously upset about it. So it's kind of fun. So I don't... I haven't come across a lot of actual, like, I haven't done research on werewolves in New Orleans, but I am doing a tremendous amount of research on werewolves in Ireland, and that is fascinating. Gypsies, werewolves, and banshees.
I love that song by Cher.
Yeah, I do too.
Oh, wait, no,
yeah.
That's Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves, isn't it?
Thieves, it's just simpler, yeah.
So close.
but there's a lot of great stuff in Ireland, so that may be a whole other conversation.
Well, if you could, you know, in talking about the vampire lore and history of this that kind of weaves itself through the New Orleans area there, are there true, maybe covens? Are there true covens that do exist there now? I've heard there are vampire clubs and portions of bars that are roped off for this vampire subculture. Now, is this leaning into the realm of urban legend again, or is there truth to these stories?
That's very true. There are covens and what do they call them, Vic? We have a vampire speakeasy, and it's the only reason that we call it a vampire speakeasy. It's called Potions, and we're a private club, or you can get the password if you are a customer of our shop. You come in and we give you the password, and you have to go through a crowded jazz club to get to the secret door, and then, you know, they let you in. But we have a coven that meets there, and the leader of it is our fang smith. His name's Maven, and he makes fangs. And they're a group of, I think they call themselves a coven. Anyway, they actually do good things. And there's another one here, Zar Ashantise. He runs Voodoo Authentica, and he has his own. And they actually don't, I don't think they like each other very much. I don't know why. But all of the vampire groups, they do good things for the community. Like Czar, they go out on Thanksgiving and they feed the homeless. But they have like meetings. But he actually does drink blood, and you can Google it. Czar Ashantise. They have video of himself. They usually put a slice in someone's back, and he drinks from their back. And Maven, I don't believe does not drink blood, but he has a huge following. And he just called me at home the other day and was quite excited that he was pronounced king. And he says, I wanted you to be one of the first to know. And I said, okay, cool, we have a king, you know. So and they take it very seriously, and they have serious long meetings. And, yeah.
Is there, cool. I know there's a pretty rich Native American culture in that area. Do they weigh in at all on vampire lore and history? I know that there's considerable amount of werewolf connection for Native American tribes, but I'm wondering if you were able to find any connection to the vampires.
No, I haven't. But you know what? Honestly, that's because I did not research a lot of that. And that's a very good thing for me to research. I will have to get back to you on that one.
Please do. Yeah, we'd love to hear more on that. Now, listen, you teased us a little bit earlier that you've been living there and have had ghostly encounters. Is that something you're willing to share with us?
Sure. Yeah, because I did not believe in ghosts. I'm from Germany, and we don't even really talk about ghosts. Like, it's just not something, you know, very little. But, you know, everybody said, well, New Orleans is such an old city, that's why it's so haunted. Well, you know, bullshit, because Germany is way older, and, you know, if anything was to be haunted, it would be, like, overrun with ghosts, Italy and everywhere, right? So I didn't believe it was because it's so old, but I tell you, there is something about this city, and when I first stepped foot in it, I didn't know it existed, and I was drawn here, and I was sick every time I left. I ended up finally getting a little apartment on one of my trips, and I ended up never leaving that apartment. I sold my house over the phone. I am so pulled here, and there are so many people that have that story. And I think there's different kinds of ghosts, and I think I've seen a couple of different ones. And I know because of the nature of my business, a lot of people come and tell me their ghost stories, both at the shop and at our little speakeasy. And they're all so fascinating and so heartfelt, so that I know that they're, you know, really true. So my first time I ever saw a ghost, I was in my apartment, and it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but the girl who moved out of my apartment moved out because of the ghost. She really did. Apparently it's root change across the room, and her boyfriend, who owned a business that I used to go to, and he confirmed that. And the time she moved out is when the ghost used to pace one way on the balcony and drive her crazy. But one night it actually pulled the covers off of her, and she literally ran out of the room that night and never came back. Well, I felt nothing, 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 never felt any presence in there. And then I met my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, and literally every single time he spent the night, the light in the kitchen would go on, and never otherwise, ever. It just never went on. And so, and then it got to be pretty dramatic. Like, we'd just go to bed, and the light would turn on. And then he moved in, and it stopped completely. But one night, before he moved in, we were sitting on the couch, and my husband, to this day, he doesn't believe in ghosts, and he's the one who saw this. He said, hey, hang on, I just saw a man, a soldier, walk from the kitchen to the bathroom. And I said, what? And we had only candles on, right? He goes, yeah, little guy. He's a little guy in an army outfit. And so, you know, we both, it was so strong that we went and looked, and there was nothing there. And so that was, you know, kind of a weird one. And nothing else really happened there. I moved my German Shepherds here and, you know, never felt anything. So that was that. Okay. Then I was walking my dogs, and I rescue dogs, and I rescue German Shepherds, and many times they're aggressive, and I rehabilitate them. So I'm very cautious when I'm walking them, if anyone's around me. Well, I'm across the street from the Sultan's house, which is supposed to be a very haunted house here. And I had both of the dogs on my left side, and I was paying attention to people around me, and no one was around me, but there was a couple catty corner on the street, and I was waiting for a car to go by. And all of a sudden, a man's arm in a red felt coat, very clear as day, I can remember it perfectly, reached across me, like almost at stomach length. And it looked like he was trying to grab the dog's leashes. And I screamed because I thought he was going to get bitten, you know, because they were both very aggressive dogs at the time. And so I screamed, and the couple looks at me, and the dogs look up at me, and I literally saw his arm disappear in front of my eyes. It wasn't just gone. It faded. It, like, literally faded away in front of my eyes. And I ran home, and I told my husband, and he was like, oh, yeah, whatever, you know, because it didn't happen to him. But it was, I mean, clear as day. It was crazy. And then the other one was in my bar. I just moved there. A gentleman named Dutch used to own the bar, who happens to be single-handedly responsible for bringing Jägermeister to the United States. Well, anyway, he passed away, and I met him. I used to know him. And his wife is still alive, but my bar is in his old apartment. And I don't know that this is him or not, but I've seen him three times. And I always see it so quickly, and I don't realize that it looks like a person. And so the other ones were, you know, different. Sometimes I've heard ghosts come out of a wall and they look see-through, and a gentleman told me about that, his story, and I absolutely believe him. So that's why I think there's different kinds of, maybe some ghosts are held in time and it's a loop that they go through, and maybe some are really, you know, trying to tell you something because they need to finish something. But anyway, this, what I see three times now, is gray, like a gray suit, but I only really see the pants because I'm usually looking down when I see it. And I catch it just real quick out of the corner of my eye. One time it walked across the room, one time into the bathroom, And then my husband was outside the apartment, you know, outside the bar getting our beer cut to come in. And I see just, you know, quickly a gray pants, really, but the suit, like walking into the bathroom. And so I thought it was my husband, just even though he was wearing jeans, but it wasn't, we were the only ones in the bar. So I wasn't really thinking about it, you know. And then all of a sudden my husband walks in the door. Well, I know darn well I just saw a man walk into the bathroom, so I went to look. Well, that was it. You still question yourself, you know. Well, a couple weeks later, my bartender is working, and she calls me at home, and she says, Maria, something really weird just happened. A woman went into the bathroom, and she came out screaming because there was a man in a gray suit in there. And that's the first time I ever even talked about it, that I'd seen a gray suit twice.
Very cool.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Very cool. Well, and how can people find you? If they want to visit your shop, where do they look? Where are you located? What can they do?
We're the only vampire shop in the country, and all you have to do is Google vampire shops or stores, and we come up first. And our website address is feelthebite.com.
Feelthebite.com. We'll have a link up for this and to her book so that you can check out both on this New Orleans vampires history and legend. Marita, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. We'll be back with you guys next week, a brand new week, as we're getting closer to Halloween. And remember, I'm hosting Coast to Coast AM tonight, so please check it out. Coast to Coast AM, the best in overnight talk radio. To find stations and times in your area, visit coasttocoastam.com. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.